From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. So, Greg Burrell, where exactly is the strategic national stockpile?
Meghna, I can't answer that one.
You can't. Okay. Is there more than one?
I can't answer that one.
I've seen reports a couple of years ago that there may be as many as 6 stockpiles around the country. Can you confirm that?
Can't do it.
Okay. Can you tell us how, if you can't tell us where they are, presuming that if there's more than one, can you tell us how big are the buildings that the stockpile is contained in?
I can give you an idea. So if you think of some of these things we call a big box retailer, you take maybe 2 of those and attach them to each other. You take the drop ceilings out and you put racking all the way to the ceiling. That's about the size of one.
So like a super Walmart, a couple of super Walmarts, you said.
Couple of super Walmarts, yeah.
So 5 stories, it sounds like, of stuff. What's in that 5 stories of containers or packaging?
So in those containers and in that packaging, we've got a lot of material. We have a variety of antibiotics, antidotes, antitoxins. There are vaccines. There are drugs to take care of people when they get sick with various things. There's a lot of equipment. We call them federal medical stations, for example, and they include beds and other supportive material to set up some of these temporary hospitals that we've been seeing in the news for a while.
Okay.
And then there are a lot of other things like the ventilators. And we've seen those in the news quite a bit.
We have. We've actually seen the Strategic National Stockpile appear in the news probably more in the past couple of months than ever. I'd say that's pretty safe. Okay, so you can't tell me exactly where it is or where the locations are. So
right.
We're going to call it like the secret undisclosed location of the stockpile. But when you walk in, I mean, is it sort of all dark and then lights just sort of turn on depending on where you go and you just look and you see masses of stuff?
Meghna, that's really exactly what it's like. So our warehouses are all set up so that they are the most cost-effective they can be. So the lights generally stay off until you walk into a particular area and the sensors light up that area. It saves us money and it makes sure that the product stays at the right temperature so it's safe and effective.
Right. So, I mean, so there are scientific reasons and efficiency reasons for that. And we're going to have a serious conversation, Greg, I promise you, but I'm going to allow myself one little moment here and say that sounds like exactly like the end of Indiana Jones and Raiders of the Lost Ark.
You know, we've heard that so many times before. I've even asked if I can show people where the Ark is, but we're not quite that. And if you look at that warehouse, it's really kind of dusty and dirty. The S&S warehouses are pristinely clean.
Okay. Well, Greg, I should let people know that Greg Burrell ran the Strategic National Stockpile from 2008 all the way until January of this year. He was the director of the Strategic National Stockpile, and he's joining us today from Atlanta, Georgia. And January of this year, was that planned, Greg? I mean, did you just say... why not? 2020, what could happen? What could possibly happen in 2020?
You know, that's a great question. So I actually began my career with the federal government when I was 17 years old, and I had planned then that at the earliest possible point that I could afford it, I was going to retire and try to do some things that were fun. And so this had been planned for many years. After 38 years of service almost, I retired January the 3rd. And I'll tell you, if I had known this was coming up, those plans would have changed.
Wow. Well, we won't blame you for not knowing that a pandemic like we haven't seen in 100 years was about to hit. You said you started working for the federal government at the age of 17. What was your first job?
You know, when we think way back there, I started working for the Internal Revenue Service, and it was supposed to be a temporary job until I got finished with college. But I found that the federal government was a place that I really felt I was contributing something. And so I stayed there and I made my career federal service. And interestingly, many other people in my family have been involved in government service for many, many years. So I really just followed in a family tradition that I didn't realize I was following in when I started.
Okay, so from the IRS, then where did you go after that?
I worked for the General Services Administration. And from there, I went to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, where I was responsible for logistics and management and so on for FEMA's largest region at that time, Region 4, headquartered in Atlanta. We responded to most of the hurricanes, obviously, on the East Coast, and all of those clearly threatened the Florida Peninsula. So it was a very active region, and I learned a lot there about how to manage emergencies and how to work in supply chain in a very austere environment.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Yeah, go ahead.
Sure. I mean, so it was a very interesting job. So I had done a lot of work in supply chain management and in warehousing materials and deploying materials and purchasing materials while I was at GSA. But when I went to FEMA, I had to learn to do that in really bad situations. So the things that work on a day-to-day basis don't necessarily work when Miami's been hit by a severe hurricane and there's flooding. So I worked with a lot of great people. I learned how to work in that sort of an environment and was able to carry that with me when I moved to CDC and ultimately became the director of the Strategic National Stockpile. So working in that austere logistics environment is something that stood me in good stead and that we were able to teach all of the people that worked for me at SNS.
Interesting. So in 2008, when you became the director, the Strategic National Stockpile had been in existence for about 8 or 9 years. Was it a job that you applied for because you're like, this seems really interesting, or was it offered to you? What attracted you to want to do this particular job?
You know, that's a wonderful question. Thank you for asking me. I did apply for the job. So not long after I joined CDC in more of a management type role, I found myself engaged with CDC in their response to Hurricane Katrina. And it made me realize how much I missed being in the space of the emergency management work that I enjoyed so much at FEMA and that I thought was very successful and really mattered to the United States. So when the Strategic National Stockpile was announced, I immediately thought, you know, this gives me the opportunity to get back into that work and do it in a different way and do something that really has a positive impact potentially on the U.S.
So this is so fascinating because it has a positive impact on the U.S. It's not an impact that most Americans would think of except in an emergency when the supplies from the stockpile arrive. So, you know, we started off this conversation. You couldn't even tell me some of the basics about where it is, et cetera. So it's one of those hidden jobs, I would say. It's one of those hidden jobs that thousands of career civil servants who work for governments across the, you know, state and federal governments across the United States are going to every single day that help keep this nation going. So every morning for those 12 years that you were head of the Strategic National Stockpile, when you woke up in the morning, what was sort of your goal for that day as director of the SNS?
So my goal for that day was to figure out what we needed to do next to keep improving our capability and keep assuring that we were always ready and could respond to whatever the nation needed. My second goal, just as important, was to support the fantastic people that worked with me in the Strategic National Stockpile, some of the most dedicated civil servants I have ever met in a 38-year career, to do everything they needed to do to keep us safe.
And how many people did you work with on a daily basis, and what kind of backgrounds and expertise did they have?
So there are about 200 employees in the Strategic National Stockpile, and they come from a variety of backgrounds. So we employ pharmacists, toxicologists, people that can help us understand how the drugs that we hold would work in a human and what we need to be concerned about and what we need to make sure people understand. We've got a lot of people with medical logistics background, both from the private sector and from DOD, and these are some of the top flight people in those jobs that I have ever met. We've got a lot of smart people that do information and planning, or that's what we call it. These are the people that look at, what do we need to be prepared for? How can we plan for that? How do we make sure that the people that we work with, like states, locals, and all of our commercial service providers are prepared to do what we need to do in that instant? They're also the people that make sure that we know exactly what's happening in a response. But there are a lot of management individuals too, people that make sure we're on point on finance, people that make sure that we're in the right space when we have to deal with a variety of policy issues. And those are just as critical to making the Strategic National Stockpile operate.
Mm. Well, Greg, hang on here for just a second, because I want to pull into the conversation right now. I want to pull in Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And Jack, we're only at the tip of the iceberg of all the things I'm hoping Greg can tell us about the Strategic National Stockpile. But what are you hearing so far?
Well, Greg and his colleagues are members and his institution are members and constituents of what Susan Mettler at Cornell calls the submerged state, the invisible government upon which we rely for our safety and security that we know nothing about. And in her view, the fact that we know nothing about such people and such institutions makes for a crisis in democracy. It makes it easy for people to say, who needs the government, you know, and to talk down expertise. When he was chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan would have the head of the Social Security Administration in, and he'd say, now, what do you spend? What's your overhead in Social Security? And the director would say, oh, it's about 2%. And Moynihan would say, suppose you had made it 3%, and with that extra percent, told the people what you do and who it is you work with and why the Social Security Administration is important to so many Americans. Wouldn't that be a useful public service? It would indeed, and it would essentially take the submerged state and make it visible. Making it visible is so important for taxpayers to know that their money isn't being wasted. It's going to people like Mr. Burrell and his colleagues who do vital work.
Well, Jack and Greg Burrell, hang on here for just a second, because there is so much more that we want to learn about the Strategic National Stockpile. So we'll be back in just a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're learning everything we can about the Strategic National Stockpile, and we're learning it from Greg Burrell, who was the director of the stockpile from 2008 all the way until January of this year. And he joins us today from Atlanta, Georgia. And we're also joined by Jack Beattie, On Point news analyst. And Greg, I'm wondering if you could tell us now, share the story of the birth story of the stockpile here, because I think it's absolutely remarkable, and that it has to do with a 1997 Richard Preston novel about a disease outbreak.
I'm not sure about that. But in 1999, there were some people at CDC who were thinking about, as many of us were in emergency management at the time, the possible Y2K bug. You know, where we were afraid that all the computers were just going to stop working. And one of the things that concerned people was what might happen if computers stopped working and somebody took that opportunity to do something really bad to the United States. How could hospitals and healthcare facilities get those things that they desperately needed in a difficult situation when they couldn't use their computer to order things and take care of people? So a few people working out of a trailer at CDC put together what we know now as the Strategic National Stockpile. That early piece was the National Pharmaceutical Stockpile, and it included a few packages of about 50 tons of material that they said they could get to a hospital to any state in the United States in about 12 hours of somebody asking for it.
Okay.
And that was the birth.
So interesting. So maybe The earlier effort is what I was reading about, because Time magazine on their website had a story that said that President Bill Clinton in 1998, I believe, he read Richard Preston's novel, The Cobra Event, which is about a pathogen, a bioterrorism pathogen that's spreading throughout New York City in the novel. And President Clinton at that time thought, well, it inspired him to think about how prepared the civilian population in the United States was for a bioterrorism attack. And then the report says that in April of 98, as a result of having read the novel, the president held a meeting with a group of scientists and cabinet members to discuss the threat of bioterrorism. And then by October 21st of 98, he signed into law a $51 million budget for pharmaceutical and vaccine stockpiling activities at the CDC. So that's the precursor of what you were talking about.
It is. So that's what kicked off the attempts to put together those initial push packages. And they were thinking about it in terms of that time. What if this bioterror event happens consistent with this Y2K bug? So that became the planning factor. That became when we needed to get stuff done.
I see.
So, yeah.
Okay. And then the stockpile grew, and the disasters or emergencies for which it was being prepared for also, I think the definition of that expanded. So what would you say right now? How would you define what the purpose of the Strategic National Stockpile is?
So what we're there to do is to get the right material in the right place at the right time. We exist to help supplement and resupply state and local response to public health emergencies. So what should happen is, when a state is responding within its state to a public health emergency, or a region that includes several states are responding to a public health emergency, once they get to the point they can no longer effectively take care of that, they need more material. They reach back to the Strategic National Stockpile, and we can supply material. Now, for many of these bioterror fears that we have, the concerns that we have over a variety of different events that might be taken by a determined adversary against us, we may be the only source of some of that material. Because if we didn't buy it, there's no market for it, and nobody else would buy it. So that we send out immediately.
Mm. And the stockpile has been used before several times, right?
Yes, it certainly has. So in 2009, we responded to the H1N1 pandemic, and that was the largest known response of any stockpile of this type of material globally. And a lot of people around the world looked at us and said, how did you do that? Because it went well. But there have been a number of other smaller outbreaks that we've helped to deal with. I think one that made the news was a botulism outbreak that affected several hundred people in Columbus, Ohio a few years back. The SNS was the only source of the antitoxin to send to those people. So a variety of small outbreaks, the large H1N1, and we also responded at 9/11. The plane carrying our material was one of the few that were allowed to fly at that point. But we had to get those vital materials to New York and into Washington. And so we did that, along with staff, to take care of it.
So, okay, so there's Two examples there. I'd love to hear more stories from you about.
Sure.
H1N1 in 2009, you said people later went back to you and said the deployment of the supplies was so good. How'd you do that? Can you tell us what it was like? Like did you get a phone call say this is officially a pandemic? It's a national emergency. Go. I mean, what happened?
So at the time that H1N1 occurred, Dr. Richard Besser was acting director of CDC, and many of us across government were on a phone call late one evening where it became clear that this met the criteria for a pandemic, that we were concerned about the possible spread in the United States. And our discussions at that point were, if this begins to affect the transportation sector, we will not be able to send that material we have that can help respond to this. So we tried to get a little ahead of that curve and send out a portion of the material we had that could help respond before it got really bad in the United States, before we lost our ability to move things. And so we worked with our states, and we worked with the territories, and we worked with some cities that are directly funded to prepare for public health matters, to send them a portion of what the total we would send would be. And we got it there in the time frames that we specified, and sometimes we were actually a little bit earlier than people expected. Everything moved without, you know, problems with the material getting to the other end and being safe and effective for use. And so we saw that as a success.
And the materials
it proved.
I'm so sorry, Greg. I didn't mean to interrupt, but the materials specifically were what?
So we sent out much of the personal protective equipment that is of interest in this event. N95 masks, gowns, gloves, face shields, and so on. We also sent influenza antivirals that most people know right now as Tamiflu and Relenza. And we made sure that those were in the States so that as this disease progressed, if it got really serious, there was material there to support responding to it.
So regarding the PPE in 2009, you had enough to supplement what the states needed.
So we had a lot, but we knew that if we were facing a severe pandemic influenza event, say similar to the 1918 flu that we've all read about, we wouldn't have enough. But we used all the money that Congress appropriated specifically for pandemic influenza preparedness to buy as much of that type of material as we could, based on scientific models and based on work with CDC and other federal agencies and departments that said, this is what we need to have. We made the best investment we could, and we used it for H1N1.
Okay. Because I was going to ask, like, how do you decide what materials to add to the stockpile and how much you're going to need? So modeling is a big part of this. In your time as the director, did you come across any models, or did the group that you work with, the experts that you work with, say, well, we have to model for the kind of pandemic that we ended up with right now in 2020?
So the experts that we work with are a part of a group that we call the Public Health Emergency Medical Countermeasures Enterprise. And it's disease experts, development experts, it's regulatory experts from across government. And they use these types of models to help inform how much of what types of things we need. You know, I think the place that we use the kind of models that you mentioned are when we talked about how do you prepare for pandemic influenza and what is the worst possible case, which gives us a top-end boundary potentially, and what's the least possible thing that could happen, which gives us a bottom end. And we try to make the investment of funds that we have available to get as close to that worst case as we can.
Okay. This is so fascinating, Greg. I have so many questions. I'm not even sure which direction to go in, so forgive me if it seems like I'm all over the map here. About 9/11, when you said that you got supplies to, I'd presume, places that needed it, including New York, D.C., Pennsylvania, because your planes were some of the only that were allowed to fly, those supplies I've been reading about, are these those push packages you're talking about?
At 9/11, it definitely was the push packages. And we sent a push package to New York, and we sent a push package to Washington, D.C. But then when it became apparent that there were other needs, we began to supplement that with other material from the Strategic National Stockpile, not really contained in those packages, but designed for response.
Now, the push packages are just – they are just – they're giant packages. I mean, how big are they? And they're just ready to go.
So if you've ever noticed out the window of your airplane when they're pulling around those tugs that have, you know, prepackaged materials in them and loading them in the airplane, it's a lot like that. And it's a number of those kind of containers that are designed to actually fit precisely in the hold of a wide-bodied aircraft so that we take up as much space as is possible so we can send as much material as is possible. But you know, what we've learned over time is as we've grown and as we've got better at logistics and as our materials have expanded greatly, what we do today is if we can tailor a package, we're not going to send a push package. We're going to send tailored supplies to respond to exactly what needs to happen. In the push package, we've got a wide variety of things because we make the assumption that that's something we can send if we know something happened, but we don't know exactly what it is. But I think that we've gotten much better at understanding exactly what something might be so we can tailor things better.
Mm. So the responsiveness to the need is what I'm hearing over and over again, and being ready to provide that response.
Right.
So, Greg, I want to circle back to something that you said a little bit earlier, that the purpose, the mission of the Strategic National Stockpile is to supplement and resupply materials that states need in the event of emergencies like this. So I want to play for you what Jared Kushner said at a White House briefing on April 2nd, so just 2 weeks ago. And he said essentially that the Strategic National Stockpile wasn't meant to be shared with the states. Here's what he said.
The notion of the federal stockpile was it's supposed to be our stockpile. It's not supposed to be state stockpiles that they then use. So we're encouraging the states to make sure that they're assessing the needs, they're getting the data from their local situations, and then trying to fill it with the supplies that we've given them.
Greg, how do you interpret what Jared Kushner said? Is he right or wrong?
I think the most important thing to understand is we believe that everybody at all points in preparedness and response have to be prepared. So what I would suggest is that while states must also be prepared, and a lot of federal funds goes to help them get prepared in various ways, we still remain that fallback, that bridge maybe into the private sector or commercial supply chain coming in to resupply.
I think a lot of people wondered about what the phrase our stockpile meant, right? Because the HHS website, before Jared Kushner said what he said on April 2nd, actually contained language that was exactly what you just told us, Greg. It said that, quote, the nation's largest supply of life-saving pharmaceuticals and medical supplies for use in a public health emergency severe enough to cause local supplies to run out. That was the purpose of the stockpile. But then that HHS website, that particular page, was changed after Jared Kushner said what he said on April 2nd. So I guess what I'm asking you, you're retired now, so I'm hoping that you can give us your honest assessment here. Do you believe that the leadership in the White House actually understands properly the purpose of the Strategic National Stockpile and is therefore using it to its fullest capacity to help the American people right now?
Magna, what I would say is it is clear that the Strategic National Stockpile is deploying all the appropriate materials and they're allocating them in the only way that seems reasonable at this point to help states and locals respond to this very difficult situation. What I can't speak to is what was the status of any kind of state or local stock at the start of this. So I think that the Strategic National Stockpile is serving its intended purpose, which suggests to me that everybody in government still understands what that purpose is.
Jack Beatty, chime in here. What do you think?
Well, I wonder if we could put this in some slightly different context. Mr. Burrell and his colleagues are concerned above all with competence, with getting things done and done properly and in time. Recently, over the last 2 weeks, first the Washington Post and then the New York Times ran long, multi-thousand-word pieces documenting what the Post called 70 days of pretty much inaction or dithering on the part of the Trump administration from the time of the first reported death in the U.S. To the time in mid-March when Mr. Trump declared a national emergency. And what one headline gives the flavor that these were days of denial, dysfunction, delay, and deceit. And these pieces show people like Mr. Burrell in the depths of the, you might say, deep state, that's the term of derogation used on the right, were signaling the administration, signaling the political appointees, the civil servants were, that there was a huge crisis, that they had to react, that they had to get material out to the states, that they had to declare emergencies. And again, Mr. Trump didn't want to hear it because he wanted a good stock market. He wanted a good economy. Looking at this, the New York Review of Books called Mr. Trump the vector in chief. In effect, for that month, he was a vector of the illness. And I'm wondering, what do people, candidly, Mr. Breaux, what do people like you and your colleagues who are all about competence and doing the people's business well, what do you think when you look at something like that, this display of, what we see in these press conferences of automania and electioneering at a time of crisis instead of the kind of competence that the civil service demands and that the country needs?
Jack, I think I'm going to reemphasize what you just said. The civil service has to remain competent and capable. You know, what we learn to do early on is we check our politics at the door when we come in. And we try to do the right thing every time, all the time, within the confines of what the current administration and our directions are. So we have a responsibility to make people aware of what needs to happen, but they have to make those decisions.
Well, Greg Burrell and Jack Beattie, stand by for just a moment. We are learning all we can from Greg, who is the former director of the Strategic National Stockpile. We'll be back in just a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Greg Burrell. He is the former director of the Strategic National Stockpile, and he ran the stockpile from 2008 all the way until January of this year. And he joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. Jack Beattie is also with us. He's On Point's news analyst with us from Hanover, New Hampshire. And Greg, a couple of just little lightning round questions for you that I should have asked earlier. And then we've got some really interesting questions from our listeners here. But first of all, I mean, if you had to say like a number, how many different types of products or materials are in the stockpile? Is it thousands, tens of thousands?
So we count that based on how many different lines of items we keep in our inventory system. And right now it's over 1,000.
Over 1,000. Okay. And many of them, as you said at the beginning of the show, are, they're medical, not just materials, but treatments that have to be kept under very particular environmental conditions to keep them from perishing. That's fascinating to me. There's a room in one of the stockpile buildings that's at what, like -4 degrees or something like that for those environmental conditions. Do I have that right?
So we keep cold chain products, those things that have to be refrigerated and those things that have to be frozen in very large rooms, the size of my house or bigger actually, so that we can maintain that limited control range temperature for frozen and refrigerated products. So it's always safe and effective.
I see. And then people who have to go in and out of those rooms are only allowed in there for, 20 or 30 minutes at a time because it's so cold.
Exactly. We have to maintain our following of all the appropriate rules to take care of our employees. And even to do that, they have to wear heavy suits like you would see people wearing in Antarctic expeditions. So it's not an easy thing to do.
Okay. And then ventilators has come up multiple times in the past several months. Do you know off the top of your head that when you left, when you retired in January, how many ventilators were in the stockpile?
Magna, I appreciate the question. I don't remember the exact number, but we can correlate pretty much everything that's been sent out from the Strategic National Stockpile, adding up to somewhere in the 20-some-odd thousand range, I think, if I'm remembering correctly at this point.
Okay. Didn't mean to put you on the spot, but I just thought I'd ask there. So listen, we got a couple of really interesting questions from some of our listeners who are in the world of public health and logistics. So I want to let them ask their questions to you. This is Michael from St. Petersburg, Florida, and he left us a voicemail about how supplies from the stockpile are distributed.
I work on private sector supply chain issues. In my experience, these supply chains are quite efficient and relatively agile because lots of money and large volumes are on the line. Do corporations perhaps on advisory boards or with coalition beef supply chain officers ever advise the government on strategic stockpile planning? Could there be more opportunities for public-private partnerships in distribution and warehousing networks for the future?
Greg, do you have an answer for Michael?
Yeah. So one of the things that we have maintained as a definite precept all through our work in the Strategic National Stockpile is we want to have those commercial public partnerships. And so what we do is our warehouses are not government warehouses. We contract for what we call third-party logistics services with people that do this all day, every day, and they do a great job of it. We kind of oversee that work, and we make sure that we're engaged with them. So if something happens, we can go in that warehouse ourselves, and we have people stationed there and pull product ourselves. But they're the best at this. The best-in-class people to move our material across the country, people that do this every day at volumes greater than the government would ever enter into, move our products for us. So those are important opportunities for us. As to advisory committees, we often engage with, say, the National Academy of Science, where we have various fora that offer an opportunity for people outside government and in other areas in government to come give us their thoughts, and we take those into consideration as we move forward.
Well, so thank you for answering those questions from Michael from St. Petersburg, Florida. We also heard from Heidi, who called us from New York State, with this question about the stockpile.
I used to be involved in public health preparedness, and I was wondering when the last state or multi-state stockpile exercise had been held, what the goal was of the exercise, and how it performed. Thank you.
Greg, that's Heidi's question. What do you say?
I would say to Heidi that there are exercises that go on across the country that tie into the Strategic National Stockpile regularly. I don't know when that last one was, and various exercises have different goals. Some of them may be to see, can you receive SNS product and make use of it properly? Some may be simply to say, can we get to the governor's office and to the authorized representative so that we can quickly request those products? Others might be to involve astute clinicians in an exercise where they recognize a problem in a patient that may suggest there's a bioterror incident, and how do we report that back and get what we need? The SNS has an exercise group that is always tied into and is always standing ready to support those kind of exercises, up to and including deploying replica material so that we keep the real stuff safe so that they can play with that.
Well, Greg, I want to circle back to the question of the stockpile, what it's in purpose is now, and how it's being used for the good of the American people. Because let's just listen to a moment of what President Trump said about the Strategic National Stockpile, and that he said that it didn't have the resources to respond to the crisis.
The previous administration, the shelves were empty. The shelves were empty. So what you should do is speak to the people from the previous administration, Jim, and ask them that question.
I mean, shelves are empty is quite a thing to say, Greg. Were they empty in any capacity?
I would say the Strategic National Stockpile has the material on the shelves that equates to the original mission of the stockpile, which is to respond to chemical, biological, radiological, and nuclear events, whether they be accidental or intentional, whether they be by a lone terrorist or by a determined enemy from a state level. And those materials are there and they're ready to go. What I would say is in the early 2000s, we were provided special money to prepare.
Greg, you still there? We're going to get Greg back on the line here because I think he's about to tell us a story about funding and especially for pandemic preparedness. So listeners, hang on here for just a second. Jack Beattie, I've been hoping you're still with us here.
Yes, I am.
Okay. So let me just ask you quickly while we try to get Greg back on the line here. I'm going to circle back to your question to him about competence and civil servants. I do feel that Greg was being quite careful in his response and understandable. But what do you think the consequence has been to the attack on civil servants that we've been seeing from not just the president, but other members of his administration?
Well, I think it's put a great burden on their conscience and on their that they have to keep, soldiering on and trying to do the right thing at a time when the president has expressed contempt for them. Not lately, but most of the past, year, the president was talking about the deep state, that the permanent employees of the government were out to get him, that they were all crypto liberals or never Trumpers or whatever. And that he set a discount almost anything that they came up with. Look what he did with the intelligence service. 17 agencies or departments said the Russians interfered in the election. The president has yet to accept that because, of course, that came from the deep state. So I think it must be a terrible time for them, the 2 million civil servants in the federal government who serve under the 4,000 political appointees, and especially because of the character of so many of those political appointees. Michael Lewis, in his wonderful book, The Fifth Risk, talks about the political appointees at the time in the Department of Agriculture. He says there's a long-haul truck driver, there's a clerk from AT&T, a gas company meter reader, a country club cabana attendant, and the owner of a scented candle company. These are people, and this is emblematic, appointed to the Agriculture Department under President Trump, as if he doesn't care who runs these agencies, so long as they're loyal to him. And I'm afraid that's the coin of the realm in this administration. Not competence, loyalty.
Mm. Well, Greg Burrell, do we have you back on the line?
I'm back, and I apologize. We're all learning this remote stuff together, aren't we?
Every single day, all of us together, without a doubt. And there's no need for an apology because this literally happens to us all the time, and it's part of our new normal. So all is forgiven every moment. Now, you were about to tell us that you were in the middle of telling us that the stockpile is prepared for chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear events. But I think you are headed in the direction of saying, however, pandemic preparedness may not be there. And is that because of the 2009 H1N1 drawdown that you were talking to us about earlier?
You know, Meghna, that's exactly right. In 2009, we used the material that we purchased with what we call supplemental appropriations, extra money from Congress for that specific purpose. And unfortunately, we never got that money back again. We were never provided additional monies to keep buying that pandemic influenza material. That material could have been used here. But the good thing is we still had some on the shelves, and we were still prepared and continue to be prepared for other types of events that could happen simultaneously with this. And we certainly hope we never are in that position.
Okay, so just to be clear, I just want to be sure I'm understanding you in the right way. So in 2009, because of that pandemic influenza, you had to use a lot of materials. And then are you saying you didn't receive supplemental funding to replace what had been – fully replace what had been used?
That's exactly correct.
Okay, so we have been a little bit behind the eight ball then for pandemic preparedness since 2009.
We have been for some time.
And in every preceding year after that, Congress didn't provide the supplemental appropriation that you needed?
Well, we continue to ask for additional funds for the Strategic National Stockpile, not only for pandemic influenza, but for all those other things we have to be prepared for. What I would say is the Strategic National Stockpile is, as are so many things, underfunded. And we understand that there are many priorities that have to be considered when things are funded. But I think the Strategic National Stockpile needs to be fully funded. And I think public health preparedness at the state and local level must be fully funded, or we'll never be prepared for this kind of thing.
I do believe that in the CARES Act, there is additional funding for the Strategic National Stockpile. Is that going to make a difference?
You know what? It makes a difference today. And I think that's critically important. We can do the things, some of those things that we need to do, we've wanted to do for years. But the reality is a one-time infusion of funds won't permanently fix these problems. That one-time infusion of funds will buy new things and help us be prepared today, but we've got to keep seeing those funds come in so we can stay prepared. And that's really what happened after 2009. We started moving away from that pandemic influenza everybody was worried about, and I think a lot of people thought, hey, we had that. We don't have to worry anymore.
This is, well, we're all learning how the lesson right now, that you can't just presume that one 100-year event happens and you're not going to see it again for 100 years. That's not how risk assessment works, right? It does make me wonder if maybe there's a positive outcome to the 2020 coronavirus pandemic, Greg, and that is the Strategic National Stockpile has the attention of the American people like it has never had before. Do you think that that attention can be used to then focus the minds of Congress to do exactly what you're saying, to think proactively rather than reactively?
Magna, I hope that new attention can do that. But I also hope that it focuses the mind and the thoughts of people at the state and local level in their government about we've got to be prepared for this. And I hope it focuses the mind of the private sector, the healthcare supply chain, that we've got to think, how can we support our customers' needs if this ever happens again? The Strategic National Stockpile is an awesome thing, and it can be even bigger and even better if Congress funds it that way. But it can never be the only answer to these problems.
It's a system, for sure. Now, Greg, we only have 2 minutes left here, and I just want to ask you, right now, what keeps you up at night since you're not there running the Strategic National Stockpile?
What keeps me up tonight, what keeps me up every night since I've left and this has started, is that I want people to know you've got a lot of dedicated people that can do some incredible things, and they're working really hard every day, not just in the Strategic National Stockpile, but across the federal government and across your local and state government, across healthcare, and we need to support those people. There will be a time to walk back and figure out what went wrong and what we can do better, and people are already working on thoughts about that. But right now, we've got to support those people. Give them what they need to be able to do those jobs that are so vital to us now and that hopefully we all understand will always be vital to us in the future.
You know, in the past hour, Greg, you have been the most passionate whenever you're talking about your colleagues. It sounds like the service that you and your colleagues have given every day means a lot to you, and you got to miss this work.
I do. It's hard to sit on the sideline and watch. But I think the role that I can play for them now, and when I retired, I said, I may not be standing there with you anymore, but I will always be your biggest cheerleader. And I think helping people understand what they do and what they need and how vital they are, but not just the SNS, but all of government, I think is my role today. And thank you for letting me share that with you.
Well, Greg Burrell was the director of the Strategic National Stockpile from 2008 to January of 2020. Greg, thank you so much for educating us all this hour.
Magna, Jack, thank you for having me with you today.
And Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst, it's great as always to have you, Jack. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Burrell, for your service.
Well, folks, tomorrow we will have reached another Friday of yet another big week in the news. Unemployment surging, the president saying he is not going to fund the World Health Organization, protests against social distancing orders. So we want to know what your questions are, what your impressions are of the week for our Week in the Review roundtable. Give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683 with your questions for our Week in Review for tomorrow's show. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.